Welcome to the Good Hard Story Podcast, where we believe that the good story and the hard story can be the exact same story. I'm Catherine Wolf, and I'm a stroke survivor, a speaker, an author, and co-founder of Hope Heals. Tune in here every week for conversations about wholeheartedly living in a good hard story. Join me in this joyful rebellion to the darkness where we discover the treasures hidden in our hurting. Friends, I am so grateful that I get to share this precious conversation from my kitchen table with you. Dr. Kate Bowler was in my house, blessing my life with her wisdom and kindness and deep, real joy. And I know you will find this conversation to be something special because she is so special. In addition to writing New York Times best-selling books and being a professor at Duke Divinity School, Kate Bowler is a survivor and advocate and communicator, and she's just a force in this world, and I can't believe I had the extreme honor of not only getting to eat cinnamon rolls with Kate and yummy muffins, if you're interested, with some delicious coffee, but also to hear her deep well of wisdom. And I hope and pray it will bless you on your journey. Hey, do you mind if I awkwardly talk about you in the third person?
I would love it.
Wonderful. What a gift it is to have the amazing Dr. Kate Bowler sitting at my kitchen table. This is just glorious. Kate has written many books. She is a prolific thinker, creator, a deep inspiration to me. And I don't really have words for what it means to, I mean, interview you sounds laughable because you don't need to be interviewed, but to share this moment and perhaps just give a nugget of goodness and truth to someone who so desperately needs it. So I would love to ask a few questions of you, but more just let you talk. I'm a huge celebrator of life. You may know that I hashtag don't wait to celebrate a lot on social media and kind of love the whole eat dessert first life, knowing that we don't know what tomorrow has for any of us and might as well celebrate. And I see that so clearly in your life. Would you tell us about how you live that out so beautifully?
Aw, thanks. Well, I guess that you and I have, we know that feeling of you didn't realize you were standing on a trapdoor and then you fall all the way down.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And it does really create an urgency that I always want just to feel like it offsets like a lingering sense of worry or fear. So I do love a desire to always, to be, I guess, more intentional about moments. So I'm a huge fan of taste test parties. I throw a lot of.
Ooh, I love that. What do you mean taste test parties?
I pick something really dumb. Ketchup, for example. Okay. What's better than one ketchup? And the answer is 13.
Ooh.
And so if I'm like going to have a dinner or something, I'll say, hey, do you mind bringing? People just sign up to bring different ketchups. Or I've done it with fries, pizzas. My favorite one was Coke products. I think we had 40 by the end of it.
Goodness, and Harris, I love this.
Harris Teeter Cola was the winner.
Oh, good to know.
But it's just the feeling that like any dumb small thing is an opportunity to for it not to be Tuesday anymore, but to be Taste Test Tuesday.
I love Taste Test Tuesday. We really love Taco Tuesday around here. And I don't know, just that notion of celebrating what you got.
That's right.
In the story that so much of life is celebrating the remains after the wreckage.
Yeah,
it has been for us of like, how can we celebrate what's left?
It is a weird feeling too, where like the surrealness of pain creates in my mind a huge love of absurdity. Like, it's almost like they sort of like meet in the sky, like just one missile and then I need another missile to shoot down that one. And I do feel that way about sometimes like the surrealness of problems. It's like, oh my gosh, is this really my life? Oh my gosh, is this really my problem? And then I find myself reaching for something like very silly. It could be dumb and small, but I mean, I like when I was like bitten by a poisonous copperhead and I was in the hospital being envenomated and I couldn't stop laughing because I was like, how is like after 9 surgeries, how is this new one, a guy looking at my leg, having marked it with Sharpie, saying, well, I guess you'll keep the leg. So I immediately like took out my laptop as I was being in quote envenomated, which sounds like a superhero in the making. And I like emailed my dad to be like, don't you know a guy who works with sharks? He was like, I do. So from the ER, I emailed Dan, who works with sharks. And I was like, do you mind if in a couple weeks I just come down and see what you do? And for some strange reason, that was exactly my like equal and opposite force of how bad I felt.
Interesting.
I want something really silly and strange to happen. And then I will, I guess I, maybe it's in the same register as wanting to feel more like if fear is like turns the volume way up.
Yeah.
I want some kind of courage that turns the volume way up too. And
right.
Then like here
it
I am.
It balances. It makes sense. I totally, I love that. And it's also kind of a rebellion.
Yeah.
To the reality. Like let's kind of rebel in a great way. That's like so with funny. More, more life and more just interest.
That's such a good description. It does feel like a, so what, I almost got murdered by the snake. I want to get almost murdered by dinosaurs
shark.
That come out of the ocean.
For sure. I think there is something to that. Like if you're going to live on the edge, might as well. Keep living on the edge.
That's right.
It's profound. Okay, to back up a minute, because I didn't share this yet, the brilliant Dr. Kate Moeller is not only a Duke Divinity professor, but a New York Times author and has written 6 amazing books, has an absolutely phenomenal podcast where many episodes have deeply ministered to me, including, but not only, and we'll put these in the show notes, The Scandal of Grace with Philip Yancey, season 7, Life After Loss with Jerry Stitzer, season 7, episode 11, and Brian Stevenson, Love Mercy, season 9. And then, last but not least, Wounded Healers with Jane Catherine Love, season 9. You should be sure to listen to that one. Honestly, of all of your amazing work, though, I am probably most deeply fascinated by the fact that you were already studying the prosperity gospel and had written books about it. Yeah. And then you get stage 4 cancer and are dealing with that.
Yes.
And if I may, in my own story, I see how I would have prided myself on not buying into the prosperity gospel. Yeah. I felt like I know it when I see it, and I'm never about that life. But really, deep down, we all have a bit of the prosperity gospel in us that we'll be the good girl, the good soldier, the good Christian, and we'll get good things.
Yes.
And you write about that in all of your writings now, I feel like, and it's deeply, deeply shaped me.
Yeah, I really was in that place where I was studying gospels of health and wealth and happiness with what I thought was like a pretty cultivated academic detachment. I mean, it was like 10 years of like going to churches and interviewing megachurch pastors and sitting in the pews with people. And I would find myself like deeply moved by their stories, but I didn't think, oh yeah, that's me. And then the second I was sick, the combination of shame and outrage I think was like that awful cocktail of somehow believing that I was supposed to be able to earn my way out of any bad situation. Am I not somehow good, God? Right. Haven't I been actually pretty boring in my sins so far? Also, shouldn't Christianity have made my life quantifiably better in some kind of freaking way?
Yeah.
Like, I just thought maybe that was more in the fine print. And then I was so embarrassed, like, to be the person that everybody, like, you know, when they're like, oh, have you heard about? And then when you're the have you heard about?
Oh, gosh, yes.
I didn't know how to feel not ashamed of how the not just moment, but the years it took of being wildly dependent, horribly dependent on everybody forever.
Isn't it bizarrely shame-inducing to suffer?
Yes.
It feels almost like the last indignity that if you are suffering, you would be made, and maybe by yourself, not anyone else, to feel shame.
Yeah. Am I too much? Is this too much?
Right. Is this too hard for
people? By the way, it's the same problem. I'm not going to give you like that little boost of being able to be like, oh, this is new information. No. It's the same horrible thing for, oh, no, and you think you can help me? Actually, I genuinely, you can't help me at all except your presence, which now you'll feel is stupid. So, yeah, let's just sit here in that.
Right, and I'm forever going to be the one that makes you feel sad about your story because my story's such a bummer.
Yes.
And
you'll feel embarrassed to tell me about your kids trying soccer because that won't count in comparison to my horrible thing.
Yeah.
And now normal friends will not be available to me.
Yeah, and that's probably an extra layer of tragedy to tragedy to tragedy is the isolation because of those feelings.
Yes.
And it's in our heads, largely.
Yeah.
But I do think nobody knows how to cope.
Yeah.
I'm probably one of the worst at coping with other people suffering because I want to make it okay for them.
Yeah, I do too.
And so it's very hard to be the recipient of bringing people into the mess.
Yeah.
And it's...
No, I want to fix it. I want to fix it before you get there because I really want you to like me. And I want you to think that I'm someone that's worth your time and attention.
Right.
And it won't be too much, I swear.
Well, now I want to pivot, but I think actually it does connect to that because probably that same deep need we have to people please and make it okay for people does bizarrely translate to our physical appearance as we want to appear beautiful and just the right tenor of fabulous and sexy and but not immodest and all the things. And pretty clearly, you are not physically, as you see, impaired, I wouldn't say. You don't have some stuff on the outside that shows up at the grocery store, ladies, they know.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I do. So I've been on a journey to accept a paralyzed face and not walking as well and all the things. But I imagine for every woman, and I've heard you write and speak about... belly buttons and new belly buttons, which I also have new belly buttons, and just the whole weird way appearance plays into all of the things.
It totally does.
And how it messes with our heads.
Yeah.
And I mean, as a Christian woman, it really messes up your faith to think that it's tied to your faith is tied to your face. I mean, that's messed up.
Yes.
Yeah. I've never said that. That's cool because it shouldn't be that way. And it is that your appearance somehow really matters now that you're suffering. That's really twisted.
Yeah.
Would you?
Yeah. And depending on what kind of suffering, it makes us look more or less culturally acceptable. And then in our own minds, it does its own horrible work. So I read an article one time, it was Susan Sontag, I think. She was writing about her own cancer and about how people... I have colon cancer, and so that immediately went into, well, what have you eaten? I get a lot of attention on if I'm fat, do I deserve it?
Interesting.
Have I taken this? Have I tried? Have I done the crazy sexy cancer diet? Didn't you know it's... I'm here to give you the good news of... whatever supplement or diet that they've tried. And
right.
I mean, I've had people hit food out of my hands because they're trying to save me from it. Like a Rice Krispie treat that I really, really wanted.
God, and I feed you scones. And this one is about delicious flaky pastry. Blueberry scones.
Which are incredible. Yeah, and like I remember the first, and I just remember in the first couple months, the confusion I felt about, because I was dropping weight so quickly because I had this growing tumor and I was incredibly sick. But then the sort of sick pride I felt at somehow being thinner.
Mm.
And then, which then immediately goes away, at least it did for me, with gaining 40 to 60 pounds in cancer, which with chemotherapy, which people were like, well, doesn't that make you thin? And I was like, oh, am I not? Like, what is going to like let me stop waging war against my body, which then feels like bleeds for days, feels taut and puffy and strange and weirdly asexual all the time. And there's a strange thing where people will just touch you all the time. And some of it isn't like, oh, I want to be reconnected to people. But then when you're like 35 and you're suddenly this asexual blob in people's minds that they feel like they have all this access to, you're like, wait, am I not a woman? Am I not? And I, with colon cancer, frequently you don't lose your hair. And so then to anyone else, I just didn't look sick at all.
Right.
I just looked not as attractive in their eyes. So it took me a long time to even just, well, and I had to work so much around the, because I was wearing a port and I had to wear a chemotherapy pack. And I mean, every time I went shopping, all I could think of was, will this blood wash out? Will this neckline irritate my, that's why I'm like deeply committed to V-necks now, is just to.
Well, you look amazing. Well,
I do. And then now every time I get to pick a shirt, like I have a really puffy sleeve shirt right now, and the intense pleasure I feel in being able to be decorative at all.
Right.
Is so horrifyingly dear to my heart.
Right. That's so fascinating. It's ridiculous if you think about it.
Yeah.
It's almost, I mean, for me, because I didn't eat for so long and lost so much weight, I think I dropped about 45 pounds and looked, I mean, really horrific, just way, way too thin and just very like sharp features and very, very almost strangely masculine and way too thin and just really bad. I think probably I looked really bad, but more than that, I felt like everyone was looking at me like I looked really bad. Yeah. And it just plays with your head. And aren't you going through enough to not be suddenly paranoid that everybody thinks you look bad all the time? And it's just a different layer of isolation, which actually brings me to the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is the comments, the words, the way that people feel they need to speak into your story is astounding. I mean, I have had the worst things said to me. I'm sure you have too. And well-meaning people who are wanting to be kind and, I mean, sweet, sweet church people who literally say, like, the worst thing you've ever heard.
The passing of the peace has just been an absolute nightmare in my life. I'm like, let's not pass the peace. Let's all keep the peace to ourselves.
Jay Wolf says, and I love it so deeply, that people want to put a Jesus Band-Aid on a bullet wound. Mm-hmm. And the reality is you're going to need a lot more of the true Jesus than a Band-Aid. You've got a bullet wound. That's so ridiculous. Yeah. And they long to stick a sticker on your pain. And it's
that's right.
Tragic.
And it's so, the fact that it's so cute is so offensive to our, like, wounded souls.
Yeah.
Which is, I did something I don't recommend, but when I, like, the first kind of awful opening up feeling was, well, so I had been diagnosed in the fall and I was supposed to die by June. And I've had a thing I really wanted to say about, like, isn't it so strange to suffer and die in a culture that wants everything to happen for a reason? And, well, I hope that reason isn't me. And I certainly don't know how to accept uncertainty and yet somehow still feel
loved and worthy in some way I can't explain other than that I feel loved. And so I tried to write this down in an op-ed, and I'd had this friend who had written an article for the New York Times, and so she gave me her editor's email, and I was like, hey, because I'd never written anything like that before. I'd just written like books that 300 people read, which I was very, very grateful for all 300 people. But so I sent this to the New York Times, and in an act of radical generosity, they put on the front page with a image of this woman looking very tragic. And it was so easy to get my email. And so I got thousands of emails then in an inbox that only I managed by myself, explaining to me immediately why I deserved or didn't deserve to be sick. And because I, sweet little dum-dum that I am, felt this like pastoral urge to be like, I will respond. I found myself talking to a million Gary from Indiana's who then I'll never forget Gary from Indiana wrote this just horrifying note to me on a church bulletin and about how everything, he said, God is just and surely you deserve to die, is what he said. And I had a minute, was like, oh, Gary, you made the mistake of writing it on your church bulletin, which means I can just look up your church. So I sent a note to his pastor and was like, dear pastor so-and-so, Gary not been listening to your sermon. And I would strongly urge that Gary receive a pastoral visit.
I love that you did that. And I really pray he followed up with Gary, because just the unbelievable things people say shortly after my stroke. One of my first times back at church, actually, a sweet, very misguided gentleman came up to me and just said, it is just unbelievable what Satan has done. And I'm like, oh, okay. And he's like, what Satan has taken from your face. And I'm like, wait, I'm so sorry. Wait, what? He's like, you're just the beauty he stole. He stole your beauty. And I'm like, wait, surely that came out wrong. That was just so just wildly inappropriate and just clearly not the biggest issue with me. So why is that your focus? And
yeah, thanks for naming my tragedy as both a satanic attack and describing me as hideous in your eyes.
Right.
I really appreciate that.
It was very messed up.
Blessed be the name of the Lord. there's a strong desire, I think, maybe, and I do think this is maybe a Christian temptation, is because we have, like when you talk about good, hard, because we have good news.
Yeah.
We then don't want to say hard. We want everything to be good.
Right.
And otherwise, God can't be good.
Mm-hmm.
And so, every version of trying to triple down on good, where the end of the story then makes every bit along the way somehow easily explainable. I mean, I think the most upsetting stuff I found was the, oh my gosh, I can't even talk about it. It's just like, it was all the heaven stuff just got to me. I couldn't and I just remember being like, in the best case scenario, our family is I get to spend my whole life loving the people I love. But in the very best version, I go to heaven and my 2-year-old son is there and I miss it all.
Right.
I miss every bedtime. I miss, don't tell me that a story that is good in this is the version which that kid doesn't get a mom.
Right.
So the shellacking of everything is in the name of making me want to, it's like bear the weight of the gospel in a way that is, it's too heavy. It's both not correct, but it's just too heavy.
I completely agree. And I think that so much of our lives, our understandings, is about our expectations of how it was going to be or how it should be. Instead of doing what you do so beautifully, what's living into what actually is. And not pining for this perfect version or this doomsday version, but just, this is the real story that I believe God's here with me in. And that's enough. And for me, I think so much of the expectations is we're expecting it's going to be just like we thought it was when we were little girls.
Yes.
And it's not.
No.
And what do we do with that? What do we do with, wait, but I got to get back to that way. And when it's not available, plenty of wonderful, sweet souls get very bitter and angry. And I'd love to hear from you. How do you combat feelings of deep anger and bitterness that it wasn't supposed to be this way? Because I see that so much with my wonderful collection of wounded healers from our camp community, mostly just a sense of like, I got to fight really hard to not be mad that this happened.
That's right. And yes. Yes. I guess, I mean, one thing that you and I do for each other, and I think we want everybody to be given back as a gift, is like, first, before any other feeling, you are allowed in every way all the radical honesty that allows all of your anger to be yours. There's no version of Christianity that makes anger unfaithful or fear unfaithful or horror unfaithful.
Yes.
Like, the wide gamut of the unfairness and the way that it feels in our bodies and in our hearts, it's not unspiritual to feel that way. And when God looks at it, I am certain that God says, absolutely, my love.
Right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I understand.
Like, followed quickly by like, I am so sorry.
Right.
This is so awful. And I do think that if we were allowed to have a lot more of our uglier feelings in church instead of our Lord, I lift your name on high feelings, even though I know all of the hand gestures to that song, I think that intensity of those feelings would diminish somewhat. Yeah. Like, I just remember thinking that like church was asking me to die like really politely. I was like, look, kind of cheerful about it and then sort of like, just do it off stage. But what I wanted, and this is actually honestly why I love Pentecostals, because they let you have lots of feelings in the building.
Yes. I'm here for it too. Absolutely.
I wanted to be able to like cry and yell and say, in this unfairness, God, I would not have picked this. And I'm horrified. I'm horrified that this is what it is. But like the bad feelings, I have needed a lot more time with because I skip them so quickly in an effort to both be and look good.
Right.
Aren't I so much more lovable if I don't tell you how horrible I feel?
And if I make sense of this and share a pretty package of how it's actually.
I'm super faithful.
Right.
I want you to know that because I'm all okay with. And I guess the second thing I have, and I don't know, I've asked around a lot about this because I felt. When you were saying like, and it is enough, I've struggled a lot with what enoughness feels like because usually nothing feels like enough. And then that immediately begins the spin cycle of, I'm not very faithful.
Right. What am I doing wrong?
Yeah. Where do I get that? So I sometimes wander around the hallways of my school having my spiritual problems and then bringing them up to like colleagues. But I have this friend named Warren and he's so cute and always has this little clerical collar on and he teaches the church fathers class. And I end up asking him bizarrely personal questions like, is there a theology of self-esteem? If so, how can I have one? And like just really awkward questions.
I love it.
For colleagues. So I remember asking him, Warren, if I just feel hungry all the time, do you think spiritually speaking, that's okay? Like if I actually do want more and I don't know exactly how to feel that threshold of enoughness. So anyway, he gave me a bunch of books. I'm like, well, Augustine said this and I came away kind of landing on the thought that like sometimes not feeling like things are enough is actually the spark that we are alive and that we want so much to keep living. Maybe it's our hunger sometimes that help like point the way to like, oh, we're like kind of almost like it's something scabbed and we're waiting for new skin. Like we're like breaking into something new and it's itchy at first. And it's like, but we're like, we're going somewhere. So sometimes I now try to pay attention to my not enoughness as possibly being spiritually helpful.
That's fascinating because I deal with this in a little bit of a different way, but I think it's the same problem is that we, like for me, I'm pretty comfortable now with my disabilities. Like I'm 15 years in, you know, I'm used to my face being paralyzed and not walking and not driving and my hand not working. And I often think like, would I want a full healing, you know? And yet, have I had the healing? And did I get the miracle? Did I not? Well, of course I did. I got the miracle, but I don't think the world would see it as a miracle. Yeah. But
because you feel whole?
Right.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I don't think I feel completely whole in every arena of my life and won't on this earth, but I feel great. And then I feel guilty that I feel great because I'm supposed to hate it. Like I'm supposed to kind of hate my life because things are so quote unquote messed up. So it's almost like a reverse guilt of like, but what if I don't hate it?
Yeah.
Then I feel guilty if I say that too loud because I'm supposed to hate it. But what if that's like the truth of who I am?
Yes.
And then you feel like, wait, but don't judge me if you're just naturally wired differently. My husband's wired very differently. And I almost don't want others to know, like, I kind of like it.
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to hate it. And what do you do with that? I'm not asking you to answer
it.
I'm just kind of airing the interesting, complex baggage that we all deal with in these stories of none of this is how it should be, or maybe it is exactly how it should be, which is kind of, I don't know. It plays with your head, Kate.
No, totally. I had a weird feeling about that too. I would fully resist anybody's attempt to kind of work backwards then and assign spiritual purpose or say that, right, it happened for some kind of reason to teach me something or whatever. But I did find, right after I got sick, the thing that had kind of broken through in my heart was this very precious sense of feeling like alive in God and in my life. And I remember saying to a person, which I just was like, please don't ever repeat this, but like, I don't want to go back. And of course I would want to go back in every other way. But like, it is a very odd thing to find a lovely, like this glittering gem. And then, but I would resist anybody else's version of wanting to do the math on that. And then be like, and see, it adds up to a this, and then therefore it's fine.
Yes, totally. And I don't want anyone else assigning any thoughts, feelings, language to it. But there's an X factor that kind of feels sort of good.
Yeah.
And you kind of don't want to say it too loud, but like, it's weird and doesn't always feel good. 100% doesn't always. But living on the edge, maybe it's kind of thrilling in this freaky way.
It has this horrible bright clarity. And like, I do feel that way. I had a scan a couple of weeks ago and I've been doing really well with cancer. But I have this feeling when I'm there, like I am alive, like it's both horrible and awful and I hate it and it is traumatizing and I feel all the like layers of like, you know, you can taste it, you can like your body tells you things about all the trauma you've been through. So I feel all of that.
Yeah.
But then I still look around and I see the same crystalline clarity of that first aliveness that I got when I realized that our days are numbered. This is short. Everything is strangely then beautiful. And every time I leave the cancer center, I always go, I'll see you later.
Yeah.
Cause like, I know it's just, we get our seasons, you know, but like all of this, I think just being able to say, I'll see you later, instead of ever imagining that we're just coming, finding the solution to the problem of pain.
Yeah.
It's my saner thought.
I love that. And so beautiful and true and right. You are so worthy of that statement. And so are you, listener, and so are we all. And it's tragic that we almost are believing that we're not, that we shouldn't see it later. And I don't know, that's very powerful. I would love to hear something I'm personally obsessed with, which is this notion of there being hidden treasure.
Yeah.
That there's some good things in suffering. And I'm sure this is so loaded for you to speak into, and you've been the brunt of endless cliches of goodness in darkness. And yet there is this X factor thing at play in deep, terrible darkness. And
I find it so easy to tell you this stuff, Catherine. I swear to you. And I mean, this is your great gift too, is that like, I want to tell you the hard stuff. And also, you're someone I don't mind telling the good stuff to, because I know you'll never like count it against.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Won't.
You
I
don't
won't.
Add it up. But I, things that have, I'm so grateful for is, I mean, I think the first thing that happened was I was humbled. I mean, I feel in like a way, and like the bad side of that coin was shame.
Right.
But the good part was, I feel the same as everyone else.
Yes. That's so, yes, that's so good.
And that feels like it opens up everybody. We're all just, there's no separation between us. And that feels honest.
And there was before.
There was. I was like a person who was pretty on top of things.
Right. And extremely well educated.
Had a really good.
Right.
Well,
yes.
It's funny you said that, because I, both my parents are academics, and we lived right near where the University of Manitoba tests manures. And so I never thought that, so the university always just smelled like crap. And I never really thought of academia as being very fancy.
Yes.
So it's that I do appreciate hearing you say that it looked fancy, because it never feels fancy. But I did feel like I had like all I ever wanted to do was be a professor like my parents. And I had a really cool plan, and I had a lot of bookshelves and maybe a smoking jacket someday, but I had a plan. And now knowing that sort of like game of lifestyle, not that version, chutes and ladders.
Yes.
Then
yes.
You can go all the way back down to the beginning. I was like, oh no, I get that now.
Right.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I feel the exact same way. It's like, there's this bizarre, like, we're all in this together on the same plane now, and I wanted to deny that before.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be above the no cure for being human, which I ordered this copy. I've read it, of course, and love it, but I ordered No Cure for Being Human for a listener who needs to hear this, that there is no cure for being human, which of all of your work, which is so beautiful, this has moved me the most in the season when I just probably needed it the most. And I'd love for you to share just a moment of, in this particular work, your heart, which is a broad question, and feel free not to answer. But I mean, I don't even have words now. Overwhelmed by that simplistic truth that, of course, there's no cure for being human. So obvious.
Yeah.
And yet so deniable.
Yeah.
And
well, absolutely. Well, I guess because this, when I, you know, I spent such a long time studying like the very, very Christian versions of the prosperity gospel.
Yes.
And then realizing that we live in a broader culture of obsessive happiness,
right?
Wellness.
Yes.
Exfoliant,
yeah,
just like you can master your life feeling. And then I think because I was trying to figure out then, well, if it's not just the high drama of those first moments of suffering, but then the like, well, then what true things can then help sustain me as I am not just sort of like in those awooga awooga early moments, you know, but like trying to go from just surviving into some version of thriving, which didn't feel possible. And so I just started thinking about all of the easy formulas that I wanted to use to kind of get my way out of suffering. Because we meet people like that all the time, right? People who are like, I just want to say that it happened and it has no impact on my life. And I was like, well, I think with chronic cancer, I'm probably never going to get to see that.
Right. I think I'm in the same boat for sure. Yeah.
So then what?
Right. Yeah. So what now? Yeah.
So I started trying to look at like, I love just like gathering cliches. So I made this ridiculous appendix of all of the like, how do you want to survive? Well, then just like make a bucket list or carpe diem or mindfulness, I think, is one of the newest. I mean, it's neo-Buddhism, so it's old, but it's, I mean, that if you just live in the moment, that you'll solve the problem of suffering.
Right, right.
And like the Calm app is a great gift from the Lord, but yeah, also creating emotional stasis is not also going to solve the problem of suffering.
No, not at all. You need this appendix in your life, friends, because we all need to know, like, it's okay to not be okay with all these things that are supposed to make it okay. Yeah.
You're not doing it wrong if you feel like you can't win. There's just not going to be winning in
100%. This scenario. Okay, last question for you, and I want to ask this every time to my guests. What's good about your life today? What's hard about your life today? And how do you live well with both the good and the hard in your life today?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question.
Good in my life today is I am in the habit of hoping. It's like a habit now. I know how to put stuff in front of me that is durably lovely and see it and feel it work its magical work backwards on me. So, and I can tell I kind of got habituated into it by like scan intervals, but I am great in 3 to 6 month ranges.
Cool.
I can feel its loveliness in my life. And so I never feel like there isn't always something really beautiful around the corner. That was never true before. And that has stayed so like good for me.
I love that.
The hard bit is I just have so much chronic pain and I don't know. It takes like a totally different kind of endurance to get up like the 50 millionth time than it did the 50th time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can feel the weariness of that. I like, cause it gets to a certain point in the day where I'm just in so much pain that I'm like, well, I don't have the mental ability to figure out the small steps to diminish it right now.
Right.
And that like, there's like creeping, there's always like a little edge of despair on that.
Right.
So
yes,
that's kind of, that can be overwhelming. So I guess maybe like the good hard then is trying to sync those two things up is like have enough like of the lovely surprise set up for tomorrow that it helps kind of propel some of the harder, sloggier tar pit feelings of managing the body I have.
Yeah. So many of my sweet friends who are tracking, including myself, actually, deal with chronic pain that is ongoing and could take up the whole of any mental space we have, which I don't have much already, so could be overcome by it.
Yeah.
But instead, like, there's too much good to let that be.
Yeah, that's right. I still want the good thing.
Yes. Right. Maybe that is the rebellion. Maybe that is the joyful rebellion. It's refusing to let it take up all the mental space that we have. And
that's good.
That's beautiful. Okay. Last thing. What does hope mean to you?
I just always think of it like, it's perfect saying it to you. I think of it like an anchor. Always.
And it is perfect saying it to me.
It's perfect for you. It is
Hebrews
an anchor.
Hebrews 6:19. Go ahead, sorry.
No, say it.
Hebrews 6:19 says we have this anchor firm and secure. And I see that like it's kind of one of the only immovable things is hope.
Yes.
I love Phil Yancey, to bring him back up, says that hope is believing in advance what will only make sense in reverse. But you may be allergic to that or both.
Well, I picture it like God drops an anchor in the future and is just slowly pulling us toward him. And that will be that, and that will be a good, there will be no tears, no pain, no Instagram.
No more sadness.
No Instagram.
No Instagram and no yucky stuff anymore.
Yeah.
All the bad things will come untrue. This has been such an amazing few moments.
Catherine,
thank you.
I love you.
I love you.
Your tender heart is a thing to behold.
Your heart, your wisdom, your thinking is a game changer. It truly is upending in the very, very most important way that a person can be. You are transformative. I mean that. And that's, I mean, what more can we be than game-changing forces in this world?
Thanks.
I love you.
Love you.
Thank you for joining us on the Good Hard Story podcast. To learn more about what we are doing, follow us on Instagram at Hope Heals. Check out all things Hope Heals at hopeheals.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this wherever you get podcasts, and please feel free to share this episode with somebody who needs to hear it. Good Hard Story Podcast is a production of Good Hard Story, LLC. It is produced and edited by Leah Case and Mary Austin Hall. And I am your fearless and fabulous host, Catherine Wolf. Come back and join us every week where we believe that the good story and the hard story can be the very same story. With you and for you, friends.